So, on the 28th episode of the Loopcast, I have Ali here, who's gonna talk about his newer crisis group paper called "Spiderweb: The Making and Unmaking of Iran Sanctions." So, for those who have been following the Iran policy debate or the nuclear issue, sanctions play a big role, and so sort of Ali will help us discuss and work through, try to add depth to our understanding of Iran sanctions. So let's start off with a history question. So give us a brief history of Iran sanctions from the US perspective. That in the paper you outline, I think, three or four phases or waves of sanctions, from 1979 to 1995, 1995 to 2006, 06 to 2010, and then sort of now. So, give us a basic history of, US, imposed sanctions on Iran.
Sure. Since the Islamic Republic was established in 1979, it has been subject to a steady stream of sanctions. And as you mentioned, one can divide these sanctions into different waves. But it's important to note, I think, that the sanctions are not the product of a single policy. Over the years, different actors have imposed sanctions on Iran. These are based on different legal systems, different objectives. Some of them are motivated by Iran's nuclear activities. Some of them are based on human rights violations. Some others are about Iran's intervention in regional affairs. But the sanctions regime really started in the early 1980s with the U.S. sanctions, unilateral U.S. sanctions. And then eventually transformed into what is now a broad international sanctions regime, which is really unique in its scale and scope. I think it's not an exaggeration to say Iran is one of the most sanctioned countries, if not the most sanctioned country in the world. The first wave of sanctions started from, as I said, 1979, and it went all the way to 1995. And it's originated as a U.S. response to U.S. embassy hostage crisis right after the revolution. And Tehran's, one can say more broadly, anti-American policies after the revolution, and its support for violent groups in the Levant. The second wave started during the Clinton administration from 1995 to 2006. And it was also mostly unilateral US sanctions, which sought to weaken the Iranian regime by targeting its oil and gas industry and denying it access to dangerous nuclear and missile technology. And the United States at that time aimed to expand the reach of unilateral sanctions through extraterritorial applications of third-party sanctions, which basically meant that the U.S. tried to compel its allies to adopt a unified stand or face U.S. sanctions. However, this aspect of the policy was not very successful until we get to the third wave of sanctions that started from 2006 to 2010. And those sanctions include both multilateral and international restrictions and sanctions that were prompted mostly by concerns over Iran's nuclear ambitions. So it's only during the third stage of sanctions that other countries also started implementing and imposing sanctions on Iran. As I said, they were mostly motivated by the nuclear program, but because of their failure to resolve the standoff over the nuclear crisis, we then got to the fourth wave of sanctions, which was in reality a tsunami of harsh unilateral and multilateral sanctions that started in 2010, and they continue until the present day. So the end result is a comprehensive set of punitive measures targeting virtually every important sector of Iran's economy. And in principle, as I said, these measures are tied to non-proliferation, terrorism prevention, and human rights. But mainly, they are aimed at confronting Iran with a straightforward choice, which is to comply with, to comply with international demands on the nuclear program or suffer harsh economic consequences.
Okay. So, you know, how do you, where do you place the United States and the EU in their approach to sanctioning Iran? I mean, it seems like, you know, if we look at the congressional debate or the debate over sanctions in the United States, it seems like, you know, the United States has been, can, you know, been quick to sanction Iran, whereas the EU has, you know, there's a bit of a lag in sort of the way that the EU sanctions Iran or the way they approach Iran. So, you know, how, you know, first for, you know, lay out the difference for us, if you, you know, between the US and the EU's approach to Iran, and sort of, you know, how does this, how has this affected, you know, how each entity, each state imposes and implements sanctions?
Yeah, as I said, sanctions have been the policy tool of choice, of preference for the US. From day one, they were the only policy that the US knew how to use in dealing with Iran. Negotiating with Iran was always difficult. Engagement with Iran was not straightforward, but sanctioning Iran was an easy solution and still is. If you look at sanctions, U.S. sanctions that are imposed on Iran, you see that the vote they get in U.S. Congress is mostly unanimous or with overwhelming majority, which is a signal that you know, how easy it is in the United States to impose sanctions. However, the Europeans were quite skeptical from the beginning. They weren't sure if Iran would respond positively to sanctions. And they started instead engaging Iran. This is mostly through during the period of late 1990s and early 2000s, when the European countries had what they called critical dialogue with Iran. And you know, instead of imposing sanctions, they actually expanded their economic ties with Tehran. But at the end of the day, you know, and to a large degree, the effectiveness of U.S. sanctions depends on coordinated action by other countries. So the U.S. was pushing the Europeans for a long time to join the sanctions effort. You know, during the early stages of the nuclear crisis, the Europeans, the three major European countries, France, Britain, Germany, started a diplomatic initiative to try to resolve the crisis. When that project collapsed and when they were unsuccessful in getting to a nuclear deal with Iran, at that stage, the EU adhered to the sanctions track. First by supporting UN sanctions and subsequently by imposing their own unilateral and multilateral sanctions. And as time elapsed, with diplomacy remaining stalled and prospects of an Israeli military strike rising, the EU increased its pressure. This was extremely important because when you talk to EU officials, you realize that one of the main reasons that they supported the sanctions effort was because they figured between military confrontation and doing nothing, sanctions was probably imposing sanctions was probably a better policy for them. They didn't want to have another Middle East war. Especially amid their own financial they didn't want to have to deal with the consequences of an attack on Iran, because Iran, of course, is much closer to Europe than it's to the United States. So that's the reason that they joined the sanctions regime. So I would say the main difference between the U.S. and EU is that from day one after the revolution, the U.S. always resorted to sanctions as a policy tool that it was most comfortable using against the Islamic Republic. But the EU was much reluctant and joined much later, and is still somehow skeptical about its effectiveness. But the problem is now there are so many sanctions and there's so much overlap between the U.S. sanctions and the EU sanctions that simply there is no easy way of rolling back these measures.
So, you know, where do we put India and China in this sort of sanctions or, you know, in this sort of economic, way of thinking? Because it seems like, you know, we read a lot about how, you know, India and China have sort of, I wouldn't call it sanctions busting, but have certainly, you know, as the EU and the United States sort of, you know, dilute their ties, economic ties with Iran, then China, India, and sort of, you know, smaller Asian states have sort of stepped up and have done business with Iran. So, you know, do we consider India and China to be sanctions busting, or do you think, you know, they're, you know, passing their own sanctions? Are they sanctioning Iran? How does, you know, where do we place India and China in all this?
Well, I wouldn't call what India and China are doing sanctions busting, many countries around the world have decided to implement only international sanctions that are imposed on Iran, not unilateral and multilateral sanctions, which they don't necessarily see as legitimate. Because unilateral sanctions basically mean you're imposing your own rules on other countries. The U.S. is basically telling other countries that you can't do business with Iran, and going in, interfering and trying to regulate their business and their trade with other countries, which is something that many other countries are uncomfortable with. That includes India and China. They have, in the bigger picture, the horse trading that exists between the U.S. and the EU with China and India and other countries, Russia included. There's always some give and take. In some areas, China and India, as well as Russia, have decided to cooperate with the U.S. in pressuring Iran. But there is a limit to that. They're not willing to blindly follow the U.S. Lead on imposing pressure and sanctions. However, China has always voted against Iran at the UN Security Council and has voted to impose sanctions, UN sanctions on Iran, and it enforces those measures. However, as I said, when it gets to the unilateral sanctions, it's not China and India are not enforcing them as rigorously as some other countries. And in that, there is an opportunity for them because Iran is a huge market. As a country of 17 million people, it has the fourth largest oil reserves in the world. It has the second largest gas reserves in the world. So there is a lot of opportunity for trade and finding markets which are not necessarily open to competition by other countries. To India, China, and Russia, and their benefit. This is a perfect formulation of in crisis there is opportunity.
So where do we put Turkey in all this? It seems like, you know, Turkey has, you know, Iran's ties, business ties with Turkey are fairly deep. I mean, you know, when I talk to people from Iran or, either family, friends, or whomever, it always seems like the Turks are coming up in either doing business with Iran or, people traveling to Turkey to buy certain things that they can't find in Iran. So sort of, where do we place Turkey in sort of the sanctions regime? I mean, are they sort of following the same path that India and China have done where, they impose international sanctions, but not necessarily their own sanctions? Or, are they, still conducting business with Iran?
Yeah, I think I would put Turkey in the same category. Although Turkey has less leverage than China, for example, in dealing with the U.S. Like the Turks, since at least a few years ago, have been importing a lot of gas from Iran. And they import almost 50% of their oil from Iran. And they don't have many other options. Either they have to completely rely on Russia, which is from energy security point of view not a very wise choice for them, or they have to go and start building pipelines and bringing gas from other places, which is again not a very attractive or economic option for them. So they are reliant on Iranian energy to a large extent, and the U.S. actually understands that and has built-in exemptions for Turkey. And in return, Turkey implements some of the sanctions imposed on Iran. For example, on the financial restrictions, Turkey has been cooperating. It has become more and more difficult for Iranian businesses to open bank accounts and conduct transactions in Turkey. Again, these, a European official told me something that I thought really crystallized the dilemma that some of Iran's neighbors are in. He said countries, neighboring countries, can afford to neither provoke Washington's wrath nor antagonize Iran. So they're basically, between a rock and a hard place. They have to make sure that they maintain good relations with U.S. and Iran, and that's a delicate balancing act. But they try to do it, some countries have been more successful in doing it than others. For example, Iraq has been sanctioned. Some of Iraq's banks have been sanctioned for continuing to conduct business with Iran. One Chinese bank was also sanctioned by the United States because it continues to do business with Iran. But there are no Turkish banks, for example, that have been sanctioned. When you look at it from a perspective of trade, trade with China in 2002 was around $3 billion. 2011 was around $44 billion. I think last year it was in the neighborhood of $39 billion. So it hasn't changed that much. With Turkey, likewise, trade has been booming during the last few years. And this is also partly because Iran learns to adopt basically adjust to the sanctions and find new ways of going around them. For example, Iran is using barter with some of its current oil customers. And this is perfectly allowed by the sanctions regime. They've been designed in a way that Iran cannot access its petrodollars, but it can use them to purchase local goods from countries where it's still continuing to sell them oil. And this includes India and China, and to some extent, Turkey. So they're settling their accounts in local currencies or in barter. And this is highly profitable for these countries. They have no reason of not engaging in that kind of business. Or if you look at some of the regional countries, they're now highly engaged in conducting smaller transactions known as hawala, which is an alternative remittance system. which has replaced banking transactions. But again, for these neighboring countries, it's very profitable because what was conducted, transactions that were conducted through official banking channels with much lower commissions are now conducted through these unofficial banking channels with much higher commissions. You know, so, and again, in going around the sanctions and using some of these loopholes in the sanction system, it is national interest and personal interest of some of these countries and their business community. So I imagine that this will continue.
So let's sort of switch our, move our focus towards the impact of sanctions, on Iran. So, what have this, the impact of sanctions been on Iran's nuclear and missile programs? Not necessarily the political calculus, but the sort of the physical aspect of the missile program and the nuclear program and, the surrounding sort of technological and, physical elements of these two programs. I mean, has there been an impact or the impact has been negligible or there's a huge impact? I mean, help us gauge what the impact has been.
The impact of sanctions, I think, is as complex as the nature of the sanctions regime itself. But in some areas like nuclear and missile programs, I think what we're seeing is a mixed effect. Sanctions have slowed down Iran's nuclear and missile programs. They have not stopped them, but they have slowed them down. This is mainly because of export controls, not necessarily sanctions. When we talk of broad-based sanctions, financial restrictions, I don't think they have much impact on the nuclear and missile programs. But export controls have made it really tough for Iran to get the primary material that it needs to construct its centrifuges or, to use to manufacture its missiles. And this is mainly because there are some material like Mirage steel or carbon fiber that are extremely difficult to produce inside Iran, and Iran relies on external sources for their import. During the past few years, the U.S. and European countries have tried to close down all the choke points through which these materials were provided to Iran. And they've been largely successful. So if you look at how the number of centrifuges that Iran has been able to install in its nuclear facilities, you will see that from 2007 to 2009, Iran was able to install around 8,000 centrifuges in its Natanz facility. And since 2009, it has only been able to install 4,000. I remember that President Ahmadinejad about 5-6 years ago said that Iran is going to develop and install thousands and thousands of these more advanced IR-2 centrifuges, which is more efficient than the current IR-1 models that are highly dysfunctional. 6-7 years later, Iran only has about 200 to 400 of these more advanced machines.
So,
so it has definitely slowed down the program.
So, what about the impact of sanctions on Iran's energy sector? Because it seems like, as a layman, reading through SSADA, reading through the NDAA 2012, it seems like a lot of the focus of sanctions, at least, as law, has been focused on Iran's energy sector. So energy sector being, oil, gas, the infrastructure surrounding all that. What would you gauge as the impact of sanctions on Iran's energy sector? I mean, has it been devastating or, oh, go ahead. Sorry.
Sure. Yeah, I think the impact on the energy sector has really been devastating, and the reason is, the sanctions that started in 1995 targeted investments in the energy sector, and that really stymied Iran's ability to have foreign companies investing their capital and modern technology in Iran. And because of that, Iran's production of oil and gas has been lagging behind other countries in the region. Before the revolution, Iran was exporting 6 million barrels a day. But by 2010, 2012, right before the recent round of sanctions, it was only producing about less than 4 million barrels a day. And now it's at about 3.4, 3.3 million barrels a day. And it has a very high level of decline every year. It loses about 400,000 barrels every year. And this is mostly because of sanctions on investment in Iran's infrastructure. The same applies to the gas sector. Iran has, as I said, the second largest gas reserves in the world, but it ranks only 25th on the list of the major exporters of sanctions.
No,
And
oh, go ahead.
it has also in recent years the harsher sanctions have targeted exports of energy. As you know, in 2012, the EU imposed an embargo on Iran's oil and gas and petrochemical products. That reduced Iran's exports significantly. And then when the U.S. passed legislation, which was called National Defense Authorization Act of 2012, it put pressure on remaining Iranian oil customers. And they started cutting down their imports from Iran. So in 2012, overall, Iran lost about 40% of its oil exports, which is significant. It's about 1 million barrels a day. And that will further exacerbate the situation of the energy sector because if Iran needs to shut down some of its wells, it will damage its oil infrastructure, and it will not be able to recover its production rates easily, even if the sanctions are smooth. So actually, the International Energy Agency is predicting that if the nuclear crisis is resolved immediately, and sanctions are lifted promptly, Iran will not be able to recover its previous oil production rate of 4 million barrels a day anytime before 2020.
So, away from the energy sector and the nuclear program, how has sanctions impacted Iran's economy? Because it seems, one of the more controversial bits of the sanctions program is its unintended consequences upon, the ability for people to get medicine. And and when I say medicine, for the audience, it's, we're not talking about aspirin or, generic stuff. You're talking about, cancer medicine, cancer medication, sort of high-end, very specific type of pharmaceuticals. So, what has been sanctions' effect on Iran's economy in general? I mean, away from, the energy sector and the nuclear program.
Well, here we're talking about a country that relies on its oil revenue for 70% of its budget. And that means that when you lose 40% of your oil exports, your economy is going to be significantly affected. And that's why during 2012, with a recent round of harsh sanctions, Iran lost about Iran's currency, national currency, the rial, lost about 70% of its value. And that's an indication of the amount of economic pressure that has been created in Iran. You know, this is, but I don't want to exaggerate the impact of sanctions on the economy. And I know that you know, there is a lot of exaggeration and sometimes misunderstanding about that because people say, like, Iran has hyperinflation, and, the economy is on the verge of collapse. You know, I think, first of all, the Iranian economy is quite resistant to sanctions because of years of turmoil and economic problems that Iran has experienced during the years. And second, it still has a lot of resources that it can use. I mean, with all the sanctions that that I mentioned and all the pressure that came to pass in 2012, Iran's oil revenue last year was $67 billion. And, you know, that's a lot of money, and the economy can still resist and survive. What Iran does usually in order to adapt is that it cuts its imports, and it imposes harsh austerity measures. And this is exactly what the Iranian government is doing, and you know, the sanctions are hurting, but they're far, far from being crippling. But as you mentioned, there's also the humanitarian dimension. There's a myriad of unintended consequences. And chief among them, I think, is the shortage of medicine, which is unintended in some ways, but I would actually call it unforeseen, because we have had experience with sanctions in other countries, in Iraq, you know, in many other countries, including actually Syria and Palestine. And you would see that usually the impact of sanctions is that when countries have less financial resources, they will have problems obtaining some of the essential staples that they depend on from the outside. And that includes food and medicine. Now, Iran has been able to anticipate the impact of sanctions and stockpile a lot of necessary staples, what they call strategic staples, which includes wheat and you know, rice and you know, chicken feed and those kind of imports. But in the field of medicine, it's a little bit more difficult because here we're talking about a highly patented area. When we talk about specialized medicine, if there's a cancer drug that is produced, for example, by Novartis, you can't buy that medicine from India or China, because Novartis is the only company that is producing that, and it has a patent. So it's not a way that you can basically acquire that medicine. And Novartis doesn't accept Chinese yens or Indian rupees. It only accepts euros or dollars. And if you don't have access to hard currency, you know, there's no way that you can obtain that medicine. But in all of these areas, in addition to the impact of sanctions, there is also a high level of mismanagement by the Iranian government. Although I think there is no way to distinguish, you know, which percentage of the problem is caused by the mismanagement, and which percentage is caused by sanctions. But the combination of these two factors is putting a lot of pressure on the Iranian people. And again, these are not completely unexpected, because sanctions usually tend to enfeeble the middle class. They tend to enable the hardliners in the political system. And they tend to strengthen transporter crime networks and smugglers. And these are all effects that the international community is more or less familiar with in other countries.
So let me, you know, what has been the impact of sanctions on, you know, the Iranian regime's political calculus in terms of how it deals with the United States and, you know, how it, you know, its nuclear stance? Because it seems like, you know, it really seems, you know, the argument here in D.C. is that the impact of sanctions has been largely on the middle class, largely on the economic class, whereas sort of the leadership has been able to insulate itself. And I don't know if this is accurate, but, you know, help us, walk us through, you know, what has been the political impact on, you know, the regime's political calculus? You know, has it changed it? Has it shifted it? You know, how has it hardened it? I mean, what is the impact?
No, you're absolutely right. You know, if the primary goal of the sanctions was to curb Iran's nuclear program and to change the political calculus behind the nuclear program, I think sanctions have been a failure. And the danger is that when the absence of any visible shift in the nuclear calculus, we tend to use the metric of quantity and severity of sanctions to measure their effectiveness. And this is how, over time, means tend to morph into ends. You know, even in our discussion, we spent half an hour talking about economic impact and impact of sanctions on energy. And in Washington, people are, you know, the impact on the political dimension, the impact on the nuclear capitalist is most of the time just an afterthought. You know, people forget that sanctions are failing in getting to their main goal, which was the nuclear program. And this is also partly because you know, the U.S. and Iran have a completely different understanding of the sanctions regime. The U.S. basically calculates that if Iran is put under harsh economic pressure, which could possibly trigger domestic discontent and uprising and threaten the regime's survival, at some stage between the nuclear program and survival, the regime will choose survival and it will give up on its nuclear program. But in Tehran, the leaders look at the situation from a very different perspective. The one thing that they consider more dangerous than suffering from sanctions is surrendering to them. You know, they believe that if they compromise under pressure, it would not alleviate pressure, but it would result in more pressure. And they know that sanctions are not only imposed on Iran because of its nuclear program, but they're also motivated by other disagreements between the U.S. and Iran. And they're not sure that if they compromise on the nuclear program, sanctions will go away. So that's why the Iranian leaders have decided that instead of change.
So let's get to the last question, because you there's a problem with the internet. Ali? Okay, we're back. Sorry about that. So let's finish off the conversation with you know, how does sanctions relief work? Like, because, you know, you make this great point in the paper that, you know, sanctions work, but they don't necessarily achieve the political end if there's no relief in sight. I think that's the argument that I got from the paper. I could be wrong.
Yeah. Just no, that's right.
But, you know, in your view, what is the best way to provide sanctions relief? For instance, in your report, you make this great point that, you know, if the P5 plus one reach an agreement with Iran, that, you know, any part of that deal would involve either freezing sanctions or, amending, waiving, or suspending sanctions for a 180-day period. So, you know, walk us through, you know, the best way, in your view, to provide sanctions relief.
Look, as I explained, now we have an impressive array of sanctions in place. And the sanctions regime has become so complex, and there are so many layers that sanctions relief is basically very difficult. It's hard to undo the sanctions regime that we've put in place. In fact, practical considerations stand in the way. The standard for lifting U.S. sanctions is extremely high. The president can revoke his own executive orders, but most of them have been codified by Congress. So he has very limited room for maneuvering. The president can either exercise his waiver power or order more flexibility in enforcing some of the penalties. But these are short-term and easily reversible steps and are unlikely to promote meaningful Iranian concessions. What is more is that not all U.S. sanctions are tied to the nuclear issue. And as I said, many relate to Iran's foreign and domestic policy. And as a result, without a fundamental reorientation of Iran's approach, which is highly probable at this stage, a significant relaxation in sanctions is simply not in the cards. And, you know, the EU sanctions are more elastic. They don't have a clear criteria for termination. But their repeal nonetheless requires unanimity, which is not always a straightforward enterprise in Europe. Also, there is now so much overlap between the U.S. and EU sanctions that the unilateral removal of sanctions by the EU will have almost no impact on the ground. So again, a European concession without a U.S. concession risk being seen by Tehran as a tactical ploy that is designed to leave U.S. sanctions indefinitely in place. And, you know, finally, I think the other challenge is that the effect of sanctions in many cases have acquired a life of their own, and they're kind of impervious, at least in the short run, to the persistence or lifting of punitive measures themselves. And this is because, you know, trading patterns, as we were talking about India and China, or consumption patterns. And this mainly applies to refineries in Europe. These have already changed, some after considerable investment of time and resources. They're not, you know, businesses are not in a habit of going hot and cold overnight. So that basically means that a short-term suspension could provide a respite for Iran. But would have a limited impact in reality, and you know, uncertainty would make many businesses reluctant to engage. So what does that mean? That means that, first of all, lifting of sanctions, I think, is simply unrealistic at this stage. And that leaves us with the option of suspending some of the sanctions. But we should temper our expectations. If we suspend some sanctions, we can't expect the Iranians to take a step that is not reversible. You know, we can't just tell them that, you know, we will suspend sanctions for 30 days or 60 days or 180 days or a year. But you have to ratify this international treaty, which is not easily reversible. So if we take short-term steps, we should expect them also to take short-term steps. And you know, in our recent report, we try to be realistic, and we try to match some concessions from the Iranian side with some rewards from the P5 plus one side, which are more or less of commensurate value. And you know, as I said, if there are short-term concessions, there are also short-term rewards. But you know, we should also take into consideration that there's so much mistrust between the two sides that it's extremely hard for them to take big steps and make big concessions. So I think the way to start the process is with very limited mutual concessions that happen at the same time, and therefore periods of 180 days that would allow both sides to verify the other side's concessions, and then build trust, and then move towards resolving the more difficult issues. Please go ahead.
Do you see, I mean, you make a really great point about building trust. I mean, but do you see there's a sort of tension between Congress and, you know, the President of the United States? Because it really seems that, you know, even if the president exercises his waiver authority. So let's say he waives, sanctions for a 180-day period to build trust, to build, you know, to get a conversation going between, you know, the government of Iran and the government of the United States. But it seems like Congress has the ability, you know, I mean, it seems like Congress can pressure the president to not necessarily exercise his authority. I mean, you know, where do we put Congress in all this? Because it seems, the joke I tell people is that it's, you know, if you want to pass a bill quickly and efficiently through Congress, you just have to append your bill name with, you know, the Iran Threat Act, or, you know, something involving the words Iran threat and regulation, because, you know, it's very easy to sort of pass Iran sanctions. So, I mean,
that's right.
I mean, what?
Yeah, but you know, this this is an interesting point, because the same thing actually applies in Europe, and it's amazing that bodies and institutions that are not necessarily very functional on other issues, when it gets to Iran, they're on the same page, and they all of a sudden become extremely functional and make unanimous decisions. And I think that applies to U.S. Congress and also the European Union. It's very difficult in Europe to come to consensus on issues between 27 member states, but they mostly agree on Iran. And you know, in my discussions with Iranian officials, I always tell them that you should ask yourself questions of what have you done that there is so much coordination between parties that usually don't agree on anything. But, you know, yeah, Congress in the U.S., I think, poses a huge obstacle to providing sanctions relief. And this is not actually just the case with Iran. I mean, if you look at other sanctions, like sanctions on Iraq, were removed 7 years after the country was invaded. The sanctions on Myanmar, Burma, have only been suspended. They have not been removed, despite the fact that that country has gone through almost total metamorphosis. There are still sanctions against the Soviet Union on the books. So the U.S. Congress lacks the flexibility that is required for using sanctions as a tool of diplomacy. It's a bargaining chip. Usually, as I said, their standards for removing the sanction are really, really high. And what the president can do is very limited. And that's why I still think the only realistic option is to start small. The president can, you know, alternatively go for a big deal. And the big deal would be easier to sell to Congress. But the big deal is also much easier to reach and much easier to hammer out during the negotiating process. And Congress has shown that it doesn't have a lot of patience. So as talks continue, and they don't necessarily reach an agreement, Congress will impose more sanctions, and the Iranians would see that as a sign of, of the U.S. Being dishonest and being hostile against them, and then the Iranians would in return ratchet up their nuclear program. This vicious cycle, which I call the race of sanctions against centrifuges, will just continue and continue. This problem will become harder and harder to resolve. Again, this is something that the administration has to do behind closed doors. It should negotiate with Congress. It's forced trading with Congress. It should try to convince Congress, first of all, not impose any new sanctions on Iran and let diplomacy enough time and space to try to use the current leverage created by sanctions to reach an agreement with Iran. And at the same time, I think not only in the case of Iran, but generally for sanctions as a tool of U.S. foreign policy, the administration should work with Congress to create new mechanisms for removing the sanctions in a more effective way. First of all, to have sanctions which are clearly targeted towards policy objectives that are 100% clear for the targeting country and for the imposing country. And number two, to create mechanisms for assessing the effectiveness of sanctions and reassessing them constantly and continuously, so that instead of just piling sanctions, we have a clear understanding of their effectiveness, and if they're not working, the need for a different policy. So these are things that the administration has to do in order to be able to use sanctions as a lever to reach a negotiated settlement with Iran. If sanctions are used as a hammer, I think initially they might look like as an alternative to war, but in the long run, they will only be a conduit to it.
So, Michael, I have a question about, it seems like, at least, in my read of, talking to sanctions people and looking at the law, it seems like, the President of the United States has a lot of power in terms of enforcement. So in terms of, not only enforcing the law, but also changing the regulations, how the law is enforced. So for example, the sort of the OFAC being able to sort of rewrite, the Iranian transaction regulations, I think it was the IFSR or the TISR. But I mean, my point is that, it seems like the executive has a lot of power in this regard. I mean, and it seems like Congress, even though it can sort of pass the law, ultimately it falls on, POTUS to enforce it. So, I mean, is there something to be said that, it's largely the executive that's in charge of the sanctions program, or is that sort of off base? Because it really seems like, in terms of, the agencies of the executive could, waive sanctions and not enforce them, or is that off base?
Yes and no. Generally, what you're explaining applies. But in the case of Iran, Congress has passed legislation that now has put in place supervisory entities and bodies that have to constantly report to Congress about the implementation of sanctions. For the longest time, the U.S. had sanctions against Iran on the books, but it wasn't really enforcing them. But now, Like the government accountability organization office, sorry, has to constantly monitor and report to Congress about the implementation of sanctions. And Congress is putting the administration under a lot of pressure. So I don't think that the president can simply not enforce the sanctions, and Congress would be willing to close its eyes on it. Additionally, you should also think about how this is seen from the Iranian point of view. If the sanctions laws remain in place, the Iranians would think, well, you know, the U.S. is asking us to put aside our strategic assets, to close our nuclear facilities, to do this, to do that. And in return, they're not going to lift their sanctions. They're saying, oh, we will not implement them. So who knows if in a year from now, in 2 years from now, in 5 years from now, when we have signed international treaties, we have closed down our nuclear facilities, they would restart implementing their sanctions based on other pretexts. So again, here is where the mistrust plays an important role. And that's why I'm saying if we just suspend sanctions, or the president just says, okay, I'm going to change OFAC's regulations and I'm going to remove some Iranian entities from the designated list of sanctioned entities, that would be seen from the Iranian side as an insufficient gesture. And in return, they will only be willing to do something symbolic. So if we're looking for significant movement on the Iranian side, the U.S. should also be willing to make significant concessions. And, with Congress standing in the way, I don't think that significant concessions are possible. So that's why I'm saying that we have to temper expectations and go for a small step that would just break this vicious cycle, put more time on the so-called nuclear clock, and allow diplomacy to find a better way of resolving this. But again, to remain realistic, I don't think this problem can be resolved in isolation, because the nuclear issue is a proxy issue of bigger problems that the international community, particularly the West, States have with Iran. And as long as those problems, those political problems, are not resolved, we can only maintain this crisis, and we can't really end it.
Well, thank you so much. I usually like to let my guest have the last sort of word or comment before we end the interview. So, give us, sort of your last, did we miss anything? Do you want to make a last point? Give us a sort of capstone to end our conversation, so to speak.
I think, let me quote Einstein, who used to say, the definition of insanity is to repeat the same thing again and again and expect a different result. So I think instead of just focusing on sanctions this much, we have to try focusing on diplomacy and to give it a real chance of resolving this problem. If not, it would result in a military confrontation that would be disastrous for all parties involved.
Well, thank you so much for coming on. Thank you.
Sure, my pleasure.